Hey, did you hear they're going to make a movie about Elon Musk and SpaceX and the Inspiron 4 mission? Yeah, it seems like they had some problems with their web server. It's going to be called Jason and the Astronauts.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
Hey, hi, hi, ho. This is WKRP with the famous Turkey Day episode. If you haven't seen that, you should check it out. I think it's all available on YouTube. I am Daniel Markham here at DanielBMarkham.com. This is Nerd Roundup. And if you haven't been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed much anything in life, but happy to have you this week. This week, what we do every week is bring up some articles that nerds have been talking about, and we just kind of have fun. I think the most important thing a teen can do is relax and joke around, and I cannot teach this to you any other way aside from just doing it myself. And so every week I have an open forum for a few friends. If they want to come by, they can. And we just kind of kick a shit around, tell jokes. This week is, like I said, Thanksgiving. And so we do not have anybody. Well, this is the first time I haven't had anybody, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 months. But Scott Anderson may come by a little later. And if he does, I'll have to tweak around the machines a little bit to get his video coming in. Let's go ahead and kick this thing off. Cool beans. Here's the list of articles for this week. Oh, yeah. By the way, I should tell you about the things I've been working on. So we always do things we've been working on first. I have been working on something I call big toe testing. And basically it's taking the EAV value and the TCR value to ATD. And I really need about 4 more acronyms. And I think I can have like a complete alphabet soup can and one thing. But yeah, I'm thinking looking at that. Where am I at here? This is it, yeah. Did some UML diagramming, sort of sketch out a little bit today. As part of that, I did the used plant UML, which is really cool. And then I quickly ran past its ability, so I moved over to the GraphViz. Hey, John! Que pasa, dude?
Hello, hello. Sorry I'm late. Had a client meeting.
Dang, clients again. Scott Ambler said he would be coming, but he would be a little late. So we're already in progress. You've missed the nerd joke. I know that it's you probably don't cry yourself to sleep tonight. Yeah, it's gonna be a hard thing.
I'm gonna have to wait till Friday to hear it.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to watch.
It is the anticipation could kill you. What you been up to this week, guy?
It's only Wednesday, isn't it? Some interesting stuff around. In addition to, clients having some real common and solvable issues with kind of being properly out in front of the product roadmap, so to speak, helping the teams be predictable, fun stuff around watching a team close the sprint, 5 issues done, 29 carried over. So, it spurs a few questions like, so 29 sounds like a lot. It
does sound like quite a bit.
And then digging into that, about half of them were because they have a thing in their process around the issue needs a fixed version. But this stuff that we're working on is for next year, a UX rewrite, and we don't have a fixed version because then we can't put it in December or January because then the release people, they see the fixed version and they would automatically go, well, wait, this isn't ready. And I'm like, oh, the twisted things that our constraints end up innocently doing to an organization are just in that little tiny 29 issues carried over. And then so I also helped them. I put that aside. I suggested we'll just put something like UX version 1. Who cares? Something that the release people won't care about. And get these guys. So I'm like, so this is just going to grow over time, right? It's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Pretty soon there's 400 issues carried over because you still haven't released this rewrite. like, you know, this problem needs to go away and needs to go away now. And then we got back to the, okay, so that meant half of the issues. Let me see the prior sprint. 4 were done. Cool. How about the one before that? 6. Cool. It looks like you do 5. So stop committing to saying you're going to do 20 because you're probably too nice. So you say yes to too many people. Anyway, that was a fun little real world problem that so many teams have that to me still seems astounding.
You know, anyway, it's funny if you knew a guy who sold like tennis shoes and you went to his warehouse and he had like 1,000 tennis shoes laying around that he couldn't sell. You'd go, dude, you got all these tennis shoes, you're not selling them, you gotta get rid of them. You can go to a technology team that has 1,000 items on their backlog, and they're just fine with that. It's like, okay, things are good. It's like, no, wait a minute. You can't keep carrying stuff. It's like, oh, it's just straight overhead. It's all it is.
And even worse than on the backlog, because, yeah, you know, being pack rats is not helpful. But committing to them. Like you actually thought about it and moved them into, we are thinking about doing these 20. Well, have you ever done 20? No. Have you ever sold 20 sneakers in a month? No.
But here's the chart.
So why do you think you're going? Yeah. Why do you think it's going to happen now?
I used to
show funny charts like that where, and I even told the team, I said, you know, as we looked at their sprint burn downs, looked like crap. You know, because, you know, some of them would go up, 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 right? The sprint would start and they'd add stuff to it. Once in a while, I'd take one down. But, yeah, that's how you get to we're rolling a bunch over. I said, yeah, my teams, I would often roll stuff over. Not that much, but a fair amount. And I didn't care because we always said we knew we're working on the next and the most important things. So as long as you can say that, I'm not going to beat myself up over the we missed, you know, some ideal burn down line.
I was just saying
but
overhead, dude. I mean, the thing is that once you allow these numbers to pile up, sure enough, somebody's going to say, hey, you know, it's time to resize the entire backlog or something. It's like this 4-hour meeting with Gyro on like the projector, and you got to, what you really need to do for folks who are saying this is not possible is you need to create a set of a master model or a set of master business use cases that says, these are 20 things my system does, and probably no more than 20. And there's a bunch of little stuff that needs fixing and tweaking, this adding, whatever. They all go in that 20 somewhere or another. And then if I'm looking at the entire project, I look at those 20. I don't go down and look at the 40,000 underneath because, you know, people being people cannot process that kind of those numbers.
No, you can't. Yeah, and you're right. I often, all the projects that I've worked on for the past early 90s, for sure mid 90s, all wrapped around understanding the problem domain, having it front and center, understanding this is our world, this is the, you know, the solution space, how we map to the problem space, but this is what we solve. This is what we do. Here's the major components to your point. And but yeah, sure. Maybe you bring in a brand new feature, say, oh, we're going to build this new other giant thing and it plugs into this existing thing. So we might expand our world, but that always gave us that firm foundation of this is what we do to your point. And that's how I solved that in the past was through kind of having a decent domain model that led us, you know, kind of gave us the dictionary, our lingo, the words from the business that we use to talk about not only the business, but the software. It mapped.
So the only shade, I agree with you, but I'm going a little bit at you. So there's the domain model, which are the things that I'm working with, and the business domain model or the business concepts I'm working with, which should be small. And then there's the business use case model, which are the things that we need to do. So one is things that exist, the other is things we need to do. And so the reason the use case model is so important is because, you know, a typical question a product owner might ask is stuff working? And if those business use cases are working, then stuff's working. And if something's broken, more to the point, it has to fall into one of those business use cases, because if it doesn't, then you've missed something important in the model. So the idea of creating that high-level model for the domain model for programmers is that we can share a certain set of nouns to work with, which is yay us. But the way you're doing it with the activity part, the use cases, is that we share the same behavior descriptions, because people want our system to do stuff, and because they want it to do stuff, then we create the domain model. If they didn't want us to do stuff, we would not do the domain
model. Right. And so, yeah, that process of creating that domain model was not in a vacuum. It was actually around, all right, what is the system purpose? What do we need to do? And so it's actually, it sort of evolves as we're building your business use cases, right? And then oftentimes there's a UX, you know, some UI design that goes along with it that acts as, so you kind of like you're doing enough groundwork and enough framework to say, this is our world. This is how, what we're offering to the end user, so to speak, and it's how we classify things. Well, yeah, and the domain model falls out of that as a adjunct to simplifying how we talk about things. You can have pictures, and you can have some classes, and you can have some attributes and connections. And
if you want the sort of 5-cent version of programming, it's that you want the program to do stuff, right? And to do stuff, you have to have a program. So I've got activity here, and I've got structure here. And then you go, hey, what kind of stuff do you want it to do? Well, and as soon as something comes out of the product owner's mouth, then you have more detail than do stuff. And to make that stuff happen, you have to have something over here. And so, it, like you said, it goes back and forth, and you develop that at a high level. And it's not that, you know, you're doing some sort of, hey, Scott's here. You're sort of doing some nerdy thing. It's that you need this as a catalog for later on when you have questions and problems and you need to organize stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Scott.
You there?
Greetings, hello, young Scott Ember. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you guys too. I'm here. Party has arrived.
So we're having Thanksgiving this week. Do you guys do anything in Canada for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, we have it. We have ours in on what you call Columbus Day, because you know we're firm believers in having good weather. Yeah, cause we can think these things through where we live, but it's the same basic tradition. Everybody shows up, eats too much, drinks too much, and then you have a fight.
Well, it's exactly the same.
Yeah. I'm arguing with the crazy uncle, and it's all good.
Yeah,
just leave him in the corner. Don't go talking to him.
In the corner. Yeah, they always. Good thing we don't live in circular houses.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, when you're in the corner and everybody's looking at you, you know there's a crazy uncle there, and you may be that crazy uncle.
Yeah,
right. Could be me.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a crazy uncle. It'd be a cool job. I'm really going to enjoy being granddad. I haven't been one yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, well, as a grandparent, your job is to spoil the kids rotten. Top them up on chocolate just before you hand them back to the parents. Yeah.
And make up a total bunch of bullshit you can tell them that they might believe until they see their parents and their parents straighten them out. When I was a kid, we walked 15 miles to the store.
Yeah. Bedtime? What's bedtime?
You
didn't believe that. You didn't fall for that, did you?
You don't believe this earth is round, do you? No, heck no.
Well, actually, I think I have now proof that the earth is flat.
Oh, really?
I can pretty much prove it. Yep. So anyway, as you know, it's mostly flat. So as you know, the Earth, the surface of the Earth is 70% water, right?
Right.
And it's
always seeks its own level.
So it's not carbonated, so it's basically flat.
Good point.
That is a good point. I think you've left out the turtle.
There's your dad joke.
It's a good foundation for our science, but it needs some turtles.
Yes, the turtles are involved, but they're off eating pizza right now. So, you know, but once the turtles come back and defend us from the rats, then we're good to go.
Turtles are sort of the cowbell of cosmology. So it's like whatever your sort of system of belief, if you add some turtles in there, it always kind of makes it a little better.
It's good.
Well, in Morocco, you know, I think the one time I joined, I was in Morocco. Speaking of turtles, they sell turtles, and people have pets, turtles as pets because it wards off the evil eye.
Really?
Wow. I have a picture to prove it. Yes.
Well,
in the market, they're selling turtles.
How many of these turtle owners have been zapped by the evil eye?
That's a good point.
Probably none.
That's science. That's science right there.
If you have,
yeah, logic.
If you have to ask, it didn't work.
Yeah.
It probably explains the turtle shortage we have here in the United States because I saw a turtle maybe 6 months ago, but you never see them like hanging out at the stores or doing things, driving around. They're just disappeared from society.
Do you guys eat the turtle candy? Like the caramel and nuts covered in chocolate?
Oh, yeah.
So, yes.
Well, there you go. No turtle shortage. You can have as many of those as you want.
Those are good. But yeah, my wife loves those, but she tells me they don't use real turtles to make those, and I was kind of disappointed.
It's real thin shell.
Yeah. The recipe changed over the years. It's like they don't use cocaine and Coca-Cola anymore.
True.
So who came up with the idea of making a chocolate that looks like a reptile? It's just... hey, see that thing down the swamp? Let's make it a chocolate look like it. It's like, I don't follow that.
I'm guessing they made the chocolate, and then they went, what the heck does that look like?
Right. Yes. And the cashews oozed out, and then that was what I was going to say. My guess is it might have been, I'll be damned. That's kind of funny. There's like four legs.
Yeah, we meant to do that.
We can do it more purposefully next time.
Yeah.
This sounds like something else that grandparent may have been involved in at some point.
That's a good story for them.
It wasn't a bug. It was a feature.
It was a feature. So this first article we have is Microsoft built something called a YARP, yet another toolkit to build fast reverse proxies, which is totally boring. But the comment on Hacker News was, why do people keep picking these yet another things for like library, let another C compiler?
Markup language. Yeah.
And I got interested in the whole idea of overloading, because there's a bazillion different camels. There's OCaml, they're all of Java. There's a bazillion overloaded names in the tech world. And this guy points out that we're missing some really good names like Druid, Beetle, Omaha. What happened to these names? Why are these things not being used for tech projects? And I don't really have an answer to that, but it's something
slugging. Yeah, like you'd think the AI guys would be all over Druid. But
Quetzalcoatl, what is that?
It's the Mexican, is it? Is it an Aztec god? Is that right? Something like that?
I was gonna say it's a place in Mexico.
That little thing in people having their aquariums is somewhere around, isn't it? That's our...
Yeah. If only we had some sort of
that's a codal, yeah. I don't know.
Some connected computers that we can look this up on, but sadly, nobody's
been that yet.
We used to pick different things for kind of like internal code words at TogetherSoft. So sometimes I think they might have been rivers, but then we used like lakes, I remember one of them was Baikal. So it was fun because I got to learn about different lakes, like Lake Baikal. I really want to go there someday. It looks really awesome.
Didn't Microsoft use they used a city name for their Windows versions, I think. Cairo.
Yeah. So I looked it up on the interwebs, and apparently Quetzalcoatl, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, is a deity in the Aztec culture. Got it right. And literature. So it's not just culture, it's also literature. His name comes from some language that means precious serpent.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Amber, but you did not put your answer in the form of a question, so we're going to have to give that to
what,
John.
What is the precious serpent god?
Yes, hence that's something to do with something in Mexico comment.
But you will not find any sort of Aztec NDEs in your first aquarium. So it's not that thing that's the...
No, it's not an aquarium at all, no.
That's a key of coal. Yeah, my friends have some of those.
I know what you're talking about. It's sort of like a newt.
Yeah, they're all cute. They're all cute little guys.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's a slightly different spelling. But yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
So the next article, I think, is one of my favorite for a while. And this is, this guy has an idea called Wind Rider. And this is not for UFOs and Elvis. This is a real serious guy. His idea is to create a plasma magnet drive and basically use the solar wind as a large magnetic sail. So it's like a solar sail, but because it uses superconductors, he actually has more, I guess, more traction on the solar wind. He's talking Jupiter in 4 weeks, Saturn in 6 weeks. That got my attention.
It goes that fast?
Yeah, the math works. Okay, I'll give you the math works. He wants it tested in space, which I'm all for. But right now, there's no way to steer the damn thing. So you got to point it just the right way.
You'll break the speed record. What's the acceleration, though? I would worry about becoming mush on that one.
Yeah, and I don't know how much.
I think it depends on how fast you unfurl it.
Yeah, here's a picture of it.
Like you go from zero to unfurled.
Yeah. So well, it doesn't have the I guess the sail part. This uses a magnetic plasma as the sail, so it just has these sort of rings of superconductors that create a plasma, and then the plasma gains traction. His idea was just to create a bunch of these and sort of shoot them at Jupiter at the right time, and then
see which ones land.
One or two.
What could go wrong? But yeah, sounds cool. Yeah, if you can learn how to steer them. Well, you know, you tack into the wind, into the solar wind.
Somebody had that idea. Some Carnegie Mellon or Princeton mathematicians came up. Here's the math that shows how you might be able to tack up to 7 degrees or so, one way or the other.
It would probably get the job done over those distances.
If you aimed it right to begin with,
you'd probably be okay. How do you slow it down, though?
It hangs on the solar wind, so you're just. And one of the ideas they had actually was send it out to the edge of the Manning Sphere, which is like 550 AU, and they could be there, I think, in 3 years, which would be incredibly faster than the
be okay. Yeah. For a program. Yeah. Hey, if they can get that built, why not?
Yeah. Cool stuff.
Yeah, very cool.
It only works when you have the sun.
Yeah.
That only solar system travels. So it's like if you get shot out too far, you can't plug back in.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I guess if they get really, really good at aiming, they just sort of turn it off when they get past the magnetosphere. Just because they're going to be hauling ass if they're going to make it 550 AU in like 4 years.
Yeah.
True.
You'd be under more acceleration for most of that.
Yeah, I believe the rule is that the speed of the solar wind stays the constant. It's just sort of the degree of it because of the inverse cube law.
So your acceleration would slow down. Like you'd have less acceleration, but you'd still be accelerating because you'd still have that push.
And one would think at some point you would be going so fast that you would be able to, you know, go to, I don't know, your solar system, I believe, is 100,000 AU. I mean, it's way, way out there, but yeah. We could do it in like 20 years. That would be pretty cool stuff. Okay. I don't know how the math works. But I know that
maybe it's all wrong. But maybe those things that we think that are, you know, the whole red blue shift things keep expanding. Maybe that's not. Maybe they're actually just shrinking, and they're staying in the same place.
I read this article last week. It was by a cosmologist and a professor. His point was that we're sort of stacking assumptions on top of assumptions. One of which is the standard candle, quasars, another which is the Hubble constant, and if you take a really serious look at these things, in many cases they're self-referential. And so we're saying that there is a redshift because things move fast, and because things move fast, there's a redshift. His point was, we may be missing some fundamental pieces that we don't have in place.
Yeah, and it wasn't a Big Bang that did this. It's just like this thing keeps happening.
Yeah.
See, this is why you bring the turtles. Without the turtles, the whole thing falls apart.
Falls apart.
Yeah.
And the Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
He's probably the Mexican turtle guy, if you really look it up. So here we have this cool site. This is a split keyboard gallery. And if you haven't seen a split keyboard, it is a keyboard split into two pieces for ergonomic reasons. And I learned that this is a thing. That people have been building various versions of this thing for some time. And there are some funky looking keyboards on this thing. Look at this. It's like a yellow, I don't know what that, yellow square that you hold like that.
It's like a sponge.
kind of looks like a sponge, doesn't it? You know, some kind of look standard, but then some are like, here's like this blue one here looks like a, I don't know what the hell it is.
Yeah. You could put it on your shoulder pads, and someone behind you riding piggyback could
yeah.
code it.
The thing is that these things are just, they're beautiful looking. And they're probably really crappy for keyboards, but there's some really cool artwork here.
Yeah. Now, some of them are, so that greenish one, because it's an issue of how close, because you want to figure out what's comfortable for your hands, and then line up the thumbs, basically, and then that's the way it works out. But I've seen chairs with this stuff built in, which I don't think would be comfortable, but who knows. But yeah, I prefer ergonomic keyboards, not these split things, but I prefer the normal ergonomic keyboards.
I had one old Microsoft one that was kind of pivoted. That was a real nice one to use.
Yeah.
I like my Cherry keycaps. Lately, I've gotten the clicky-clicky ones, and I like kind of banging
them. You want to, yeah.
I don't get any more progress done when I'm coding, but it makes me feel like that I'm expressing some sort of emotion.
I just don't get the gaming keyboards with, like, the glow-in-the-dark, and like, why bother? But
Alienware, like, changed colors, and it was awesome stuff. I don't know why people got it, but
it's funny.
I don't know why I got it so I could look more nerdy, but I don't know why other people did. The other people are pretty stupid, but I bought it for good reason.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, if you're interested, guys listening, there is some... Look at that purple one. That is...
Yeah.
It's got a trackball, and it's like a...
I can imagine if you're like a, if key presses mean something, like I know special keypad for this one, I helped one group re-architect a new foreign exchange trading platform. And they talked about, it was a cool gizmo that the traders had. It was really hard to get any time with a trader. Because they're making money, and they don't want to talk to stupid dev people. Like, no effing way. Like, they'll probably have a piss bottle at their desk. But the this special gizmo, basically, you could barely detect how fast they were making trades and doing stuff. So for something like that, a special purpose keyboard, it can make sense from... Maybe for gamers trying to get a nanosecond speed advantage due to some ergonomic thing.
I'm using my Logitech, this is a cheap one right here, but I have a couple gaming mice, and they've got like 50 buttons all over. It looks like something, it's incredibly complex.
Yeah, I can understand that, but for me doing my job, pretty sure typing is not my problem.
Yeah, you don't need that, class inheritance button to hit right away, or
right.
minimum to boss, status report button.
Yeah, the refactor this button, rename that button.
Angry letter.
Anyway, I'm sure if Bob Martin was here, he would tell us there's a button on his keyboard that automatically runs all the tests.
That wouldn't be bad, actually.
That would be too bad, no. I've been looking to TCR this week. Some friends asked me if I would do speaking at a testing conference, and I sort of ignored TCR for a while. It's a test commit revert thing that Ken Beck came up with a few months ago, and his idea is it's TD sort of at warp speed. It's too much to discuss here, but it would be cool to have a button that did that. This next one is Amazon Ion. Amazon Ion, if you do not really think you need a new data transfer standard, you're wrong, because this is yet another data transfer standard. And I have to admit, this is the first one I like. And the reason I like it is it's just JSON. But they added a couple things to JSON to make it strongly typed, so you got kind of loosey-goosey, who cares, it's JSON. And you've also got the, this is really going to be a date coming to me. And that works for me. I like that. Interested in Amazon Ion, it is AmazonIon.com. And you can see here's
just the concept. I was going to say just the concept of multiple generations of software evolution, and that hunk still works. It's like a lot of APIs that relied on if something relied on someone else's API or web server, something like that, and all of a sudden it stops working because it couldn't survive multiple generations of that thing because it changed in the version and just went poof.
This is kind of what I like because you hit the nail on the head because they're not, this is not a XML or an XSD, you know, create your own schema deal. This is, hey, you're going to be using JSON. Can't we have like a dozen different primitive types we use from here on out? It's like, yeah, kind of makes sense. I get it.
Some of these kids might want to learn about COBOL. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, there's only, what, three types, and I think one of them was a mixture of the other two.
Multiple record layouts. Did you guys do the things with the record columns?
Yeah, because it had to fit on cards or something, or you had to worry about the memory size block. You know,
when I started learning programming, you had to do, when you did COBOL programming, you had to do this multiple record layout thing where you're like, columns 1 through 7 is this, columns 8 through, and that's what you had to feed COBOL in order for it to do anything.
That's because it was either coming off tape or off cards or off of DB2, and DB2 is expecting a specific thing. Otherwise, it would blow up in your face at the time.
Funny, some bad, of that stuff's still thing. Running. Some of that's like 60-year-old sure stuff still running.
Yeah, I never did COBOL, but software engineering, I did like master's work in software engineering, but I was an aero engineer. And I remember one of the professors who I really liked, he said something about COBOL, but he said, don't snicker. And this was a while ago, so probably in the 80s. And he said something like, probably most of your paychecks are written by some program running COBOL. So I never touched it.
I would argue that I think you'd be hard pressed to do a financial transaction, electronic financial transaction that didn't involve hitting at least one system or control.
Yeah, I would agree with
you'd
that.
Be very hard pressed to have that happen.
I quit.
Except maybe in a brand new startup.
Yeah, even then, but in the back end, somewhere you're going to cross a system somewhere that's got a legacy thing running.
If you want real money, at some point you're going to hit COBOL.
I left computer science because of COBOL and a couple other things. It's just, I was taking this stuff and I was like, gee, this seems old to me, and I'd rather do Visual Basic and see. But I'll give this to COBOL. It seems like an honest business programming language. It's, you got this, you want that, you make these transforms. C is like, you know, you've got this sort of nuclear weapon that's part chainsaw and part like a ninja thing. You can do anything. COBOL's like, hey, I got a business problem to solve it. That seems a very straightforward type of language.
Give me some data, I'll process it. And I'll be happy doing it.
Fortran.
Yeah, Fortran. Give me some numbers and I'll process them. And actually get the calculation right. That's a nice feature.
Speaking of old times, misremembering can be a sign that your memory is working optimally. And I want to send this guy like some cookies or some money or something because he was dead on whatever his name was. I don't remember where I got this from, but it's a very important article. His point is that our memory system is not a computer storage system. And in fact, we're sort of making and reinforcing memories as we remember. And so when we misremember things, it's just a sign our memory system is sort of searching out to find any sort of path it can, which is what it should be doing. This is like people are broken, and if you're broken in this way, you're probably okay.
What does this lump of chalk look like? I think it looks like a turtle. Well, then they're turtles.
Yeah. I swear we were eating turtles at that bakery.
Yeah, you noticed that they didn't have any chocolatiers near the turtle store there in Morocco, I bet, probably because... either the store or the chocolates, but not both.
Not both, yeah.
So speaking of silliness in general, fun, this was a satire site posted about a week ago. It's called the MFT Bay, and this is the non-fungible transaction bay. And so we have movies and various things that are copyrighted. We have the Pirate Bay that gives these things for free. These guys are like, hey, maybe we should invent the non-fungible transaction bay. And I just kept thinking, you know, damn it, they stole my Little Pony pictures and they're giving them to everybody now. So it's...
I just paid $17 million.
I just paid $17 million for the smiley face, and now anybody can see it. Yeah, funny stuff. Crypto, like, the hype is way, way out here. There's some really... I think there's some good stuff, but that... God, the hype is incredible.
Yeah, it's a whole nother world. Every once in a while, there's a glancing blow of NFTs that I see pass by stuff I'm looking at.
Best review I saw kind of, today, I'll put it for next week. I wrote an engineer's overview, crypto, NFT, Web3, and it's about a 20, 30 minute read, but he goes down each topic and says, this is bullshit, this actually works.
Yeah.
Cool. NFT Bay. Okay, so here's the only sort of quasi-political article I have, and I want to slap this right because I don't want to talk about the bullshit everybody else talks about. So this is Queen's University launches a process to verify claims to indigenous identity. As I understand this, if you claim to be a part of this minority group, they're going to give you a DNA test to prove that you are part of this minority group. And therefore, you can either do special things or not special things. And it just seems to be one of those issues of, you know, you create a metric and then you start managing to the metric. I'm fine with whatever the political politics is fine with me, but it's like, this. I don't understand how you can help somebody to be better if you're giving them a test for something that's not apparent to begin with.
Like, yeah, well, I think in this case, if I remember this is a Canadian issue. And this lady is in charge of the Indigenous Studies group at some university. I can't remember what. And she got burned for not being Indigenous.
I think that we had a similar thing happen in the States with a lady who's leading some sort of Black Lives Matter who was not actually African.
Yeah. I remember her name.
Is, like, if you don't, like, you know, you get told, you know, tall tales by your relatives. And unless you verify it with one of these DNA tests, you really don't know. And because the relatives are usually have been told tall tales by their relatives and so on.
It's really a categorization. I mean, the reason I thought this was interesting is it's categorization, it's ontology, it's epistemology. How do you know anything? I'm adopted. And so I never had any idea whether I always hoped I was like part Zulu warrior or something. Just be a cool story, but it didn't work. My wife was told that she was part Native American. We both got DNA tests. I actually am not part Zulu word, nor is she part Native American. So like Scott was saying, you hear these stories passed down and you don't really have a way to verify it. But
yeah, I think Senator Warren, said she was some part Indian. Who knows? It could have been from her, that same kind of thing, just passed down and just assumed it was true. And got tested and basically has the same amount that pretty much anybody would have who might have tested, sort of thing. Not exactly.
The risk of continuing. Have you guys heard of the Magic Negro problem? Okay, so the Magic Negro is a meme in movies. And the overall theory is that we go through cycles with minority groups, whether we either oppress them, then we ignore them for a while, then at some point they become sort of magic. And so, you remember in the 70s, we had Native Americans showing up and telling us that the earth was hurting and we should do that. And for a while, and I guess in the 90s or 2000s, there would be a Black person in horror movies who would know what was going on and would actually be able to get out. And my point being, we go through this cycle where these minorities then become sort of these stereotypical semi guys. And then we go back through the cycle again. So it becomes a part of sort of a treadmill euphemism. It's a cool topic, and I have no problem with whatever they want to do in Canada as far as politics goes, but I don't like this genetic testing for stuff. It kind of bothers me.
Well, I'm worried about the privacy issues. I would not have ever submitted. Well, you know, you're adopted, so you've got motivation, but I would never submit my DNA for anything, because if that data ever got out and the insurance company started to use that against you, and they will eventually. Then,
well, Gattaca was a good movie, I think, in the 90s about DNA testing. And we think of this, if you remember Star Trek, the Khan, the whole Wrath of Khan thing was about DNA. we think of this DNA stuff in terms of absolute good or absolute bad or smart or strong, but we talked about polygenic testing a while back where they look at groups of genes to do things and groups of genes to do something else. It's much more going to be the case, I think, that you're going to say, okay, well, we've got enough genes in here for him to qualify for that, and also we think his IQ will be 10 points better. And it'll be this sort of shopping list of things you want to have your kid have. And that's just kind of, it makes me uncomfortable.
And if you make the incentive to appear as a certain way, yes. I'm pretty sure we can tweak that mRNA type, because it's a dynamic gene therapy type thing. You know that, oh, look, now suddenly I'm parts, Bigfoot.
This is my problem with this. This is suicide. As a libertarian, I'm in favor of what are you going to do in your body? I believe you should have to do this. I'm fine with that. But I believe that once we begin incentivizing and creating systems around processing people as if they were items, whether it's genetically or kill them or whatever, these systems tend to sort of take a life of their own one, and we get things we didn't ask for later on.
There's going to be some nasty unintended side effects. Guaranteed.
So that was the year we managed to go past that. Now, this next one's a holographic camera. Is able to see the unseen around corners, through fog, human tissue. I've been following this for a couple of years. This is freaking amazing. The basic idea is you send out a bunch of coherent light through lasers, and then you have the computer reconstruct not the light itself, but the reflections of the light off the surroundings. So you're able to see around whatever's in front of you to whatever's behind you. That's just amazing. They're talking about being able to, like I said, through fog inside people's brains, wherever you can hit light against sort of a background and then measure reflection. And the thing is that you can imagine the amount of processing it would take to go through and do the reverse engineering of all that.
It's a lot of digital signal processing, that's for sure.
Yeah. But
not to mention the model.
Huh. Oh, yeah. But if you look at some of these game machines, like for a couple grand, there's some pretty amazing processing power available to you.
There is.
Scary. Absolutely scary. And look at these games. I don't know if you've seen modern games. Holy crow. It's almost
like and they are astounding. Because I started off my sort of game career with, floppy disks and Quake and, that kind of, pretty sketchy stuff. And then the flight simulator we used for F-14 flat spin training and a 50-foot arm centrifuge, with a 4,000 horsepower motor. We had, I'm going to say it was a SP, something like that. We had an out-the-world visual display system.
Yeah.
We used a cyber supercomputer to run the models. Fiber optic cable, we had, digital, A to D stuff in the cockpit, and we had an outside world display. So that system for the outside world display sucked, even compared to my PC back then, which was right at the cusp of PCs just, the graphics cards going crazy. But I think the system was like $1 million. And it was, because so the pilot could sit in the cockpit and looked kind of okay. It wasn't, the resolution was laughable. To your point,
so
it's crazy what you can do now.
Check this out, guys. I saw this this morning. This is real-time controlled CGI puppets in Unreal Engine. So I saw this. I'm like, hey, it's a person. But no, this is not a person. This is a CGI puppet, and the puppet's making different faces. So you can have, and it looks to me, it's completely photorealistic. I couldn't tell the difference between this and a real person. Yes.
Unlike Terminator 2, which I believe to do that, the graphics on Terminator 2, I remember when it was coming out, they said something like how much time it took to do like a second of film or something crazy. I'm sure the shots were that scary dude who was like made of metal.
Yeah.
Like you get half his head blown off and then come back in the
shape. Space Nine had Odo who could do shift his shape, and that was really, really expensive to render.
Yeah.
Now you've got all kinds of systems.
Did you guys watch The Expanse? Or did you watch Foundation?
Expanse. I haven't watched Foundation. Friend said it wasn't that good. You were the friend, actually.
Yeah. If you had foolishly read the books and expected them to be close to the plot, then it wasn't that good. But from a special effects point of view and just cinematography, it was amazing.
We're watching Wheel of Time. Is that on Prime? In Wheel of Time, I'm at the point where I can't tell whether it's shot or shot in composite or completely composite. I don't know.
So. Yeah. Well, at the beginning, I watched the first two episodes. In the beginning, you know, they show this valley, and it's very obviously a city that's overgrown with weeds and stuff like that. And I couldn't tell the difference. Like, I inherently knew it was wrong. It was, you know, fake. But I couldn't tell.
Well, yeah, you know, Lord of the Rings, they did a lot of shooting in New Zealand, and you could see sort of when they backed the panorama, you're like, okay, this sort of looks like it would be New Zealand, but this stuff now is like, did a computer generate this entire landscape? Because they do, it used to be they couldn't do like a flying camera with the CGI, that you could do one or the other. But now they can do the whole thing where it looks as if they're moving the camera around and the reality stays the same, whether it's real or not.
Yeah. And it's cheap enough for TV shows.
Cheap enough for TV shows, yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as long as the bikini models still keep befriending me on Instagram, I know those are real people. I'm okay, but you know, once they start faking those people out, then I'll start worrying about.
Do they make faces?
They'll make faces.
Yes.
It's a scary place we're going with that. I don't know. But I have a rule, like, if somebody befriends me, I'm a friendly guy. I look at what they posted, and if they have like two pictures of them on the beach, and then I'm okay. No, that's fine. I'm really turning down all supermodels right now.
I don't even know why people are falling for these ads. Like, I've tried reporting them, and it comes back as though they're real. They're not real. Come on. Like, you know, okay. Yeah, like, this is very obviously some sort of phishing scam. And why aren't you doing something about this, right?
You're just lonely.
Yeah.
It's all just lonely looking for.
No, you mean us are lonely, not some program like in Nigeria. Go follow somebody. These guys are scammers.
I haven't seen many of those. I haven't seen many of those lately at all, now that you mention it.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, the Nigerian scams? People have finally caught on to that after 20 years. But
I guess maybe they're all doing the car warranty now.
Well, you know the thing they said about the 4-1 or whatever they call it, the Nigerian. They called it the Nigerian thing for a while. And people pushed back and said, look, if it says you have a Nigerian prince, it's fake. But the cybersecurity guy said, you know, really, they know it looks fake. And they keep doing it because it's a filter for them. If you buy into this bullshit they send you to start with, you're pretty gullible, and then they're going to want to continue talking to you. So the fakeness itself becomes sort of a tool for the people sending the mass emails out, which is not what I
sucker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now I've got to check like ugly people like at Walmart. If I get like an invite, it's like I've got a bunch of ugly friends in there. They're like, oh, I may know this guy from school.
Yeah.
Right, it'd be real.
Be a techie.
You know, one day it's gonna be like me. Hey, David, that's me.
Yeah.
Hell, I'm not gonna be friends with myself. This next one is called pony messaging, and you do not get to message ponies, which I was disappointed with. But the idea is that it is a message service that only delivers and picks up 3 times a day to prevent you from sort of emotioning over people and having flame emails and all that. It's a purposely delayed messaging system.
Okay, Pony Express, I guess. But yeah, it'd be a good way to train yourself, like, you know, for initial, you know, get off the dopamine hit of responding to emails. That might not be a bad thing. But
I find that as I've been home more with COVID, I put my phone away and get it out only at certain times, and it does the same thing. Otherwise, it's beeping and calling, and I'm being.
Yeah, turn the beeps off.
Yeah, turn all messaging off. As soon as they get like a pop-up, like, no, you gotta go. No more.
Huh. I don't know. My gut says this will just crash and burn.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. No way saying anybody's going to use this thing.
I'm just trying to think of the use case. Because it's not for communication that you need.
It's time. No, it's time management. It's I'm totally overwhelmed with messaging, and I can't control myself. That's what that is.
Well, you could like tie this into a Pomodoro system where it in cycles would let you do the work and then give you interruptions at certain times. That might work.
But I'm thinking this is not like a layer on top of, all right, feed me all your mail clients and I'll you know, firewall them and meet them out to you. This is like some extra thing that you and I, you know, the three of us might want to get some pony messaging and only be bothered once a day for shits and grins.
I'm just thinking it's a total... It's a networking problem. The thing is that there's three guys using this and if they're lucky, it'll be four guys.
Yeah.
A networking effect.
Yeah. I don't know, but more power to them. They must think there's a value proposition here somewhere.
Well, if nothing else, the reason why ideas like this is they stir interest in the community, which might lead to new ideas. So it's not as if it's a waste of time. It's like, okay, I put this together in programming so we can have a sort of group chat with the nerds all together, and maybe they'll add something to some other feature like Gmail later on.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot to the notion of, like, if you want to be disrupted a lot, install Slack at your company. If you want to be really efficient at communication, install Slack at your company. I mean, right? I mean, it's good and bad. And if people, I don't know, I always feel like if you don't have an established protocol, I used to try to fight it. Now I just don't care. But, you know, it can be super disruptive. The person disrupting you gets what they need, and you're just fucked.
Yeah.
So I think,
but they're good. They get done answer when they leave. They don't care if they interrupted you.
The real feature should be in like tools like this, where I should be able to turn off. So if I should be able to set a rule saying, if I'm in a team, like, you know, in the Microsoft platform Teams, if I'm in a meeting on Teams, I don't want all my Teams messaging and all my Outlook messages popping up while I'm on a call. Leave me alone. Right. And that would be something that's integrated platform. That's a feature of an integrated platform that I would expect. I don't have it, but I would expect that. That would be a good feature to me because I could see people adjusting it. Right. If I'm in certain types of meetings or this time of day, don't send me anything, or this time of day, send me these types of messages. I could see setting up a set of rules.
It's funny. Yeah, I ran into this interruption problem very early in my consulting career. I mean, maybe in the late 90s. As soon as I got a job with a lot of people involved, and your email was just ding, 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 it would become a thing. Remember, I was working. I was working at the immigration service for a while. I was there for 2 years, and became a release manager. And had, like I said, my email was going crazy, and they asked me if I would stay for a third year. I'm like, you know, guys, I will, but only if we can work on our own project and get out of this bullshit. And like, okay, we'll give that a shot. And so, my friend and I. Set up a project, we've got five people involved, you guys are dropped. I'll continue my story then. Here we are, losing your internet connection.
My Google.
Hey guys. So I'll continue my story. I was working at the immigration service. They asked me how I would stay. I said, hey, if you'll let me work on my own project and leave me alone out of the bullshit, they're like, yeah, why not? We set up a small team. I just turned my email off. From that point forward, I just did not get email. Eight or nine more months. And I'm like, hey, where's Daniel? I guess he's getting his email. They never knew, never figured it out. I was happy. Things were good.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I would often say, if it's urgent, come see me or call. If it's, it'd be nice to have an answer relatively soon, Slack, that's cool. Otherwise, throw it in an email and I'll do it on my time. Now, people would push back and say, well, you can control Slack. You can set up some things and say, do not disturb. And, you know, so when you need to be in that mode, I know, but so, yeah, it's like, all right, I feel like get off my lawn guy or something.
Well, yeah, the thing is, it's not just one app. It's like a one app.
Yeah. You got to, you got to do not disturb on seven apps.
Yeah.
I can't remember that. No way.
And the thing is, the weird thing, the even funny thing about that job was after I left, I still kept getting emails from these assholes because I guess I never read any other ones, so they just kept forwarding me all the new ones. It was like 3 years getting emails from this job I'd left. It was.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it was fun times. They were really important emails, too, because. The country of China launched a hypersonic glide weapon this past week, and it caused quite a stir in the DoD Pentagon because we've been talking for the last year or two about, hey, Chinese have these hypersonic things, we want our own because it's not fair. And now they've launched theirs, and not only did it go Mach 6 plus, it shot off its own like little baby missile while it was going.
Oh, that's sure.
And the thing, nobody thinks they could do that. Scientists are like, this is impossible. But yet, it happened. There is a missile.
You have to have something to inject it out at Mach. I mean, that sounds hard to be able to. It's one thing if you
let it go. You're going to Mach 6, so you let things just fall off, and then their engines kick in, and goof, go.
I agree. I think that's the only way it would work.
But then you'd probably spin. You'd have a nasty spin problem with anything you let go. But if you could figure that one out, because
you're behind a hell of a shockwave, that's for sure.
And I think the thing that frustrates me about this whole story is that we were doing this with the X-15 in 1965, Chuck Yeager. We were building hypersonic planes, and we just dropped that entire program to go with the Apollo Gemini program. And instead of like building planes that flew really fast, we built these multi-billion-dollar rockets that were real expensive and kind of their own little money pit. And now we're like, hey, you know, maybe we should have built the really fast planes all along. It's like, yeah.
You can't have all the toys.
Well, that's it. Yeah, we had the cool space pickup truck.
We spend enough, Scott. We should be able to have all the toys.
But it's interesting though. It gets back that you spend all this money on all these toys, and then you get your butts kicked by a bunch of guys in a used Toyota.
Yeah.
And then we leave them with all of $80 billion, $70 or $80 billion worth of really good equipment. Yeah.
Then you leave all the toys behind.
Yeah, like complete assholes. So now you know, like Russia. China's got that. Whoever the hell bought our Apaches, and yeah, just don't remind me.
Probably
the most embarrassing.
Why didn't they blow them up on the way out? That I never understood that.
They gave them to the Afghans. A lot of that stuff they gave to the Afghans were allies, and we couldn't just blow up their stuff. We gave it to them, and so they just ran away.
We could have.
Yeah,
should have.
I probably would have.
If we had a half a brain. Because basically the Afghan army just dissipated. So, yeah, it was really, I'm pretty sure a kindergartner could have figured out a better approach.
I wouldn't worry about it. There's no way that's going to bite them.
No. So I was working at the Department of Defense.
Not a chance.
I was working with DoD several years ago, and the guy I reported to was a Navy commander who did logistics. And he came in one day, he said, maybe I'm wrong, but he said, I really think we should know where 40,000 containers are in Iraq right now, and we have no idea where any of them are. Oh, my God. Yeah, so you do not understand, wastes of money and time. The DoD is like its own Jupiterian scale of this stuff. It's beyond our ability to comprehend.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that for a second. That's why you need to let FedEx or UPS or some actual logistics company run it. Somebody who cares about being super effective, efficient, and tracking everything and not losing shit.
I watched a 3-hour video a month ago about how to have a startup idea, get the Department of Defense to buy it, and the whole 3 hours was a consultant telling me that I had to hire consultants to do a bunch of paperwork to fill out the program stuff to get even $20,000. So it's a game just to get in the game.
Oh yeah, the paperwork is nasty. When we were running the VA company, well, we were also a foreign national, so it's next to impossible. But even if we weren't, it was absolutely brutal trying to work with the government. It's set up for these big companies. So if you're a little company, the cost of filling your paperwork is just crazy expensive.
Yeah, they say you have to have your own person doing it, and you should not rely on the payment, because the payment may take 6 months or a year after you bill for it to show up.
Yep, and you'll get nickel and dimed on everything. It'll be crappy work that you had to, work really hard to get. Oh, yeah, it's just everything again. It's all set up for the big
company. And the funny thing I thought was so interesting when I worked at different levels in government contracting was that at a higher level, it's really who knows who. It's set up to be this sort of monstrous paperwork system with cross-checks and all this stuff. But once you move 3 or 4 levels up, it's like, okay, we've worked with Norfolk Grumman for a while. I know Joe over there. He's reliable. We'll bring them on. And the rest of it's sort of getting everything in line so that will happen.
Yeah, then we'll run the RFP process to make sure they win. They'll have 2 other bidders that were guaranteed to be screwed on day one.
Yes.
Every so often, there might actually be 2 potential companies that might win the bid, and then there'll be the 3rd they bring in to make it look as if they're actually following the process. Our sales guy used to just explicitly ask, are we the 3rd bidder? Because if we are, we're not interested. They would almost always say, yeah, you're the 3rd bidder. You have no hope.
Then you know you're bid fodder. The company I'm working with now, I remember way back, somebody brought something. Oh, look at this opportunity of the government or something like that. I flat out said, did you help write the statement of work? Or the RFP, rather? Yeah. No. Well, then it's not for us.
Yeah, you lose.
The answer is no.
Yeah.
Because if you had nothing, there might be a fluke out there where some literally, virgin RFP appears and it's legitimate and they really do want to compete. It's a first, but most of it, I worked 10 plus years, maybe 50, in DOD consulting. Yeah, you gotta, it's, the odds of you just randomly getting a new contract are slim to none.
And not trying to rag on big government, this is true, large organizations of people everywhere. One of the things that amazed me was that you reach a certain level, you don't actually do anything that you can be pinned down on. So, for instance, I had consultants tell me that at the executive level, they would make all the presentations for their boss to give to other people. And then there's SOW, they would write this. So they just handle everything, and the guys are there sort of as props to sort of look as if they're making decisions.
Yeah, that's why I just don't trust most things that are big and large and behemoth, because the same crap just happens, because I think that's natural.
Well, natural evolution. I have 4 kids, and I realized that I was just sort of a puppet at one point in my life. And you have to accept these things or keep going. You are who you are. Yeah. What have you guys been consuming? You been reading books, watching any good TV or last week or so?
I watched the last episode of Foundation finally, so I'm happy about that. And I just discovered that the Perry Rodan Neo series from Germany is being translated into English. So if you don't know who Perry Rodan is, so Perry Rodan was a space opera. They first originally written in German. It was translated into English in the 70s. It's the longest running series of books in history. It's, I think they just hit issue 3,000 or 4,000.
How many?
3,000. I think it was 3,000. Because it comes out every 2 weeks. And it's been coming out since the early 60s. And so it's this human who's now immortal because good things have happened to him. And going through the history of mankind going out into space and being the force of good that we are. And sometimes the force of evil that we are. But anyways, so they rebooted the series. So in the States, they translated the first 140 some odd, and that ended in the mid 70s. So I read those when I was a kid, and I started rereading them now. But
read all 3,000.
It's like German. It's German pulp. It's pulp fiction. Really not that good. But they have a new series that I guess they started in the 90s in Germany to get the new generation, because it was all a bunch of old guys like me reading this stuff, right? So the market was disappearing for some reason. And so they restarted it and they reset it in, I think, the 2040s or 2050s with newer technology and good stuff like that. But anyways, I just discovered because I'm on the Perry Rodan discussion forum, and somebody just blurted out, hey, you know, they've translated the first six of these. Yay. So my plan is to start reading them because it sounds like they're doing a decent job of it. Because the stuff from the early 60s is not that good.
Wow. But so, the second time through, they have the benefit of like figuring out what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. So it sounds like this from the description of the books, it sounds like the same basic storyline. But the technology is updated because, computers were this new weird thing that was ultra, ultra huge. You know, early 60s, what are you going to do, right? So, so their vision of the future was, typical of the early 60s, and it just doesn't fly anymore. So before I forget, I
was reading Sooner or Later Everything Falls Into the Sea by Sarah Pinsker, which is an anthology of sci-fi stories.
I
enjoyed it, made it halfway through, and I fired her. I'm just sad to say that. It was good, but when she did a good short story, it was almost meditative, contemplative, like, okay, this author has some legs. But then she went to this, an hour and a half just sort of meandering around, like, I have this subject I'm interested in, but I don't really know what my opinion is, so I'm going to have my character sort of argue it back and forth, and it's like, yeah, I'm not really sure that works in a long-form novel, but in a short story, you'd better have a storyline that you nail early on. And I'm sorry I had to fire her. She did a really good job up to that point.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting, earlier you were talking about Wheel of Time, and I couldn't get through the first book. I found it way too long. He meandered all over the place, and it was easily twice as long as it needed to be.
Watching these shows, I'm like, okay, this guy's this, and then it's sprawling. I'm looking at like 40 characters in just 8 shows. It's going to be very difficult to track, I think.
Yeah.
Imagine like writing that down.
By contrast,
drawing the character map.
War and Peace or Anna Karenina, Tolstoy did the same sort of sprawling novel, but it all kind of worked together. Big Tolstoy fan here. Maybe you guys didn't get that from him, but you can make it work.
Yeah, but he had like a billion characters or something in his story, in War and Peace. It was a crazy number of characters.
I have yet to see anybody that could concisely like nail a character in a novel. You introduce a guy within 3 or 4 paragraphs, like, hey, I know this. I like went to school with a guy just like this, and he managed to keep that personality throughout the whole story. He's amazing amount of work there. I think my biggest problem with Tolstoy, especially in War and Peace, was about 3/4 of the way through, he stops telling the story and begins sort of in this old cranky guy kind of mode about how things are all screwed up and how Napoleon wasn't that great a guy. He was just a product of his army. And he does that for a few pages. I get the point. And then he does it for 300 more pages. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. We're just, I'm not, are you sit in it? Get in the corner. You can do this all you want, but I got to eat some more turkey on this side. It's not going to work.
Yeah. But it was, did you guys ever read the Game of Thrones novels? No. They were actually pretty good. And the thing I really liked about them is he had absolutely no, he didn't care about killing off main characters.
Oh, cool.
And you'd be reading, and it was one of, I saw this interview with him, and it was basically his attitude was, it was like medieval times, world was harsh, and you'd just get killed. It was what it was, you'd be following along with this character for like a couple books in some cases, and you'd love this character, and then suddenly you'd be reading along, and then there'd be one paragraph where like somebody comes behind them, and stabs him in the back. And you'd stop and go, wait a minute, what the hell happened there?
And you'd go back. I like that guy.
Yeah, I like that guy. And you'd reread the paper. Holy crap! He just got killed for no reason.
So I've been interested in how to plot novels for some time because I'm a writer, and it's something I have difficulty doing. And I was taking a course 6 months ago. He brings up Game of Thrones. He brings up the first episode specifically. As they introduce, I guess, some nice person that observes the cruelty around them and everything, and then they kill him. You're with this guy, bam, he's dead. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, well, one of the, so I watched the show in the entire way through, and in the first, I think, five seasons, they pretty much followed the books. And then they deviated, and that's basically where they ran into trouble. But in the last season, they should have been killing off way more people than they were. And it was really, because they had these horrendous battles, and they're, you know, you'd start out with like 2,000 people, and the only seven survivors were the seven main characters. It would be like that nonsense. Like, really?
You gotta kill your darlings. Yeah. You get these characters. Yeah, yeah. You make them interesting. You torture the shit out of them, kill them, bastards. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just like too much of that. To the end. And they all the nice characters pretty much lived, and all the bad characters got it.
I think that's an audience feedback loop going on there, where people were like, oh, I really like whatever, and then they're afraid to kill them off because people like
it. Right. Everybody hated them. They got killed. It was this, you know, Game of Thrones was this cultural meme that was going, everybody was talking about Game of Thrones at the time. And then they had that last season, and then boom, shut it all down. Everybody hated the last season. There was like nothing good to be said about it. And yeah, it killed it. It was the weirdest thing to see.
Wow.
They sold out.
I was going to say, as far as yeah. A thick book, it's been a while since I read it, probably 10 or 11 years, but Atlas Shrugged.
Is that a big book?
Pretty thick. Yeah. There was probably 200 or 300 pages you could have ripped out. They're a little bit boring, but. But I thought the characters were developed pretty well, I thought. It's been a long time since I read it, but that's my recollection, is they were pretty discrete characters with discrete values and personalities. And the triple DVD series, to your point, Scott, about, yeah, the book was so much better. But what are you going to do with a book that's this thick and that expansive to try to shove it into something that someone would consume a few hour and a half chunks?
Well, what's the
so had to, it felt fast. It felt like they didn't develop the depth of character, you know, and they just breathe, kind of did the breadth, not the depth, which, yeah, probably like the books you were talking about. That
Melissa's a big
foundation.
Melissa's a big Stephen King fan. And so the one big book I've been kind of itching to go back is The Sand, which was a freaking monster to begin with. And now there's an unabridged version, which is, I don't know, 1,800 pages or something. Yeah, King just, he's in his cocaine beers. He just kind of gets in there, wanders around for a while. But he does a really good job of it. If done well, you know, you can tolerate a long book.
Yeah. Yeah, the TV shows were pretty good. There was a TV series, like a mini series about 20 years ago, that was pretty solid.
Yes.
And then a couple of years, it might have been a Netflix thing. A couple of years ago, there was another TV miniseries where they did a pretty good job of it too, and it was, you know, same basic story, but you know, done better.
Well, they have the same problem. I think the one with I want to say Richard Hammer, but there was the older one had a bunch of stars in it. The problem with these, it's a different genre, is the problem. So when you move to TV, Arthur C. Clarke had a famous falling out with Stanley Kubrick over 2001 because Clark was writing sci-fi novels and Kubrick was making movies. And it's just, you know, those who don't always get along, it's very difficult to make a miniseries follow along with like a long book and have it all called together.
Well, I think it ends up, the writer has to go in expecting it to be converted into a TV show or a movie. So for example, if you read the Expanse books, I think they wrote the first couple and they just told a straight storyline. Like, you know, there was no going back and forth in history and all that sort of nonsense. It was all just a very straight linear story for the most part. And then whoever picked it up, you know, read it and said, hey, we could make this into a TV show. And then they took that and ran it. But then the newer books very clearly were being written to be turned into TV seasons because it was an awesome recipe. It was a nice thick book. Each one was a nice thick book, and it converted phenomenally well into a single season that stuck together, a bit of a cliffhanger at the end. It was really, really, really well done. And obviously,
you mentioned this, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is amazing to me because I can tell reading a novel, and I never realized this before today, I can tell whether the author's actually picturing a movie or TV show, or if they're actually just writing a story. It's like, okay, this guy's obviously writing, I guess, cinematography or whatever. It's
hoping to get picked up. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Robert Sawyer. Do you read any of Robert Sawyer stuff? He's got a couple of really good, but he had one, a trilogy about the World Wide Web waking up, which was sort of interesting. But he had one, I think it was called the Neanderthal series, where there's an alternate Earth where the Neanderthals lived. And then they have their culture, we have our culture, and you can, somebody builds this machine to go back and forth. And there's some rules where, you know, you can only go for a month or so, and then you automatically come back, sort of like, you know, the Warlord of Mars thing. And, but anyways, but it's just this interesting juxtaposition of cultures and the way the world could have been if we weren't so greedy. So it's a really good series. And so that was good. But that was obviously written to be turned into a TV series. And I'm partway through the Oppenheimer effect. But basically it's what if it's an alternate history thing where what if the team that built the bomb continued on. And I'm just at the beginning of it, but the reviews I've read, it's supposed to be a really good series, but it's blatantly set up for TV or a movie, probably a TV, you know, 8 or 10 show series. But he wrote Fast Forward. That was a cheeseball TV show about 10, 15 years ago. Really good book that they messed up for TV. They should have just done it as a single season. Like do the English thing. Just do a one shot. We're doing 6 episodes. We're telling a story. It is what it is. Not this, you know, aiming for 5 season stuff.
So I did this thing about 5 or 10 years ago where I did this. I took a college lecture on best of English literature. And then I went back and started reading some of the books I thought would be interesting. Worst thing in the world I could possibly do. And the reason why was, once you read all these great masters, like, these guys, the new guys suck. It's like, why can't you write this way?
Yeah.
Good stuff. So let me close this up. Let's see where I'm at here. That's true. It's yet another hour that you completely wasted watching Nerd Roundup. We're happy to have you. I'm Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet.